This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Staub Audio Engineering. If you have listened to any of the episodes, you have undoubtedly heard me talk about Mike and the phenomenal audio engineering work that he does. His mixes and masters are truly some of the best that I've ever heard. I love working with Mike on all of our Dreamfield tunes, on all of our Summit One tunes. He is an absolute wizard. Make sure to hit him up, inquire about mixing and mastering prices, and take your tracks to the next level. Oh, yeah. And Mike is also one of the nicest, kindest human beings you'll ever meet. Definitely hit him up and work with him.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all of the producers, artists, and creators that are tuning into the show. My name is Cody Christensen, and you are listening to the Chilled Samples Podcast.
Welcome to the podcast, man. This episode is like 7 months in the making, so I'm stoked to finally have you on screen to screen. And when I say 7 months in the making, that is primarily to me not keeping my email inbox clean and organized. So it's on me. But Max, how's everything going, dude?
Going well. Thank you for having me. And this is a pleasure. I love the Chilled Samples vibe.
Yeah, well, thanks, man.
Podcast is great.
Yeah, well, it's a pleasure to have you on. And we were just chatting about where you were located right before we clicked record. So if you just want to take a moment to tell people who you are and where you're based out of.
Yeah, so I'm in the Los Angeles area. I live in a little area called Echo Park, which is pretty central to East LA, I would say, and pretty close to the Echoplex and the Echoes, two pretty prominent venues, and the Echo Park Lake. So very central, you could say.
Is that where the Dodger Stadium is located?
Yep, super close.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm like a 5-minute drive from there.
Nice, man. Are you from there?
I'm from San Diego, actually.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, I was born and raised in San Diego, and I've been in LA for about like 6 years now, I want to say.
Okay.
I'm around there.
Nice, man. Well, when did you first start making music?
I started playing bass. It's actually funny. I was at a wedding in Colorado this last weekend.
Oh, nice.
And it was one of my best friends who grew up across the street from me, and he kind of like got me excited about music or wanting to be in a band at least. And his metal band would practice in the garage across the street, and I'd go over and like listen. It's my good buddy Ryan Mack. And shortly after that, I was like, you know, I want to play an instrument. And so I started on bass, and that's kind of been the bass. That's like my main instrument for sure. It's what I'm most comfortable with. And I've played a lot of shows. Usually I'm playing bass when I do that. And so, yeah. And then from there, I think the songwriting thing kind of happened. And then after that, like the producing thing really happened. And I take that pretty seriously now. And so that led to, you know, piano would probably be my second instrument, but with everything else in between.
Nice, dude. What part of Colorado were you in?
The wedding was in Golden.
Oh, okay.
So like 30 minutes out of Denver. So
yeah, it's a beautiful.
It was cool. We did some, like, I was with some high school friends, and we did some river rafting. There's like this river. You pay like $25 to get a raft, and you run up it, and it like takes you all the way through the little town of Golden.
Yep.
And then once you hit the bottom, you can get back up and run up top and do it again. So it was great. It was a really beautiful weekend.
Awesome, man. Yeah, well, I'm definitely biased, but everybody can use a Colorado weekend every once in a while.
Where are you based?
So I'm in Southern Colorado.
Oh, you are?
So
okay.
I was previously based in Lafayette, Colorado, which is right in between Boulder and Denver, and just moved to Southern Colorado in the foothills of Monta Vista. So super rural environment. As far as like the romantic idea of like a cabin in the woods for like an artist or like a writer, I'm living it right now. And it's
the Bon Iver of lo-fi over here.
Yeah, it, dude.
Hell yeah.
I love it, man. I love it. When I go for runs, like it's
I've seen one lady walking her dog one time. I've seen two rattlesnakes, and I saw a group of cowboys on horses one time. And that's all I've seen in all of the miles that I've run since being down here. But I do.
Well, when I run around in Echo Park, I see we got a lot of trash, some you know a little bit of fires. You know, there's a lot of one of the things I love about running around is I have. Like all my backyard furniture is all grabbed from just off the street in Echo Park because people will, you know, be done with a chair or whatever or like a, yep. Or a dresser or whatever and they'll just put it out front and it's like someone else deal with this kind of thing. And there's been a handful of times I'm like, that's kind of a sick coffee table. Like maybe I should put that in my backyard. But there are parts of Echo Park that are really beautiful though, I will say.
Yeah, dude, that's funny. My girlfriend's office desk is kind of the same thing. It was just sitting on a curb, and me and my buddy we had gone for a walk, and we were walking by, and we were like, "Dude, this is a really nice desk." And now it's made it like two moves with us. So I feel you. One man's trash is another man's treasure.
Yeah, I was just gonna say that. My dad always told me that.
Man, so let's so did you start playing bass in like high school?
Yeah, I think it was like middle school. And then I like started playing in like kind of rock and punk bands and indie bands and starting in high school. And that's, yeah, that kind of got my start to being really passionate about music, you know? I think when I first started, it was all about the technical aspect. And I was like learning Primus songs and like wanting to shred and like... be, you know, do like something really, you know, technically savvy. And nowadays, like, I don't want to play any notes. I'm like, the least amount of notes, the better, you know, that kind of thing. So, high school is when I really kind of got into it. And then I did a bunch of touring through my like late teens, early 20s. And then I kind of through that period a little bit, I got into like producing and, I have this indie band that that is recently defunct, but it was called Inspired in the Sleep that I kept going for like 10 years. And one of the first records was a lo-fi record, but not in the lo-fi we're talking about. It was like that kind of like Tune Yards era of like the indie, you know, or like Youth Lagoon and all that, where it was like these bedroom producers like just creating stuff that, you know, they obviously didn't have like access to like a nice studio and the nicest mics and the proper way to do things, but they still made this cool sound out of it. That was like one of our first records. I did a whole record like that. And it's so interesting to me that like I kind of, when I got into lo-fi, I like kind of got back into this space of, I don't know, like not putting so much pressure on everything being the ideal sound that I guess from other people's expectations at least. And, you know, like on a pop record or something like that, like, you know, they like ideally would want, but that's changing now too, though. Even pop music has got a bunch of influence from lo-fi, but, you know, they want the ideal vocal tone and the drums are going to be perfectly mic'd and da 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 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so I went through a phase of like, yeah, really trying to polish everything that did musically and make it be the best, most ultimate sound. And then I kind of, when I got into the lo-fi stuff again, I kind of got into this like, well, let's do something that has character and have put the importance on that and something that has like a unique aspect to it as opposed to like the most, I don't know, ideal by standards sound or whatever. So yeah, a little full circle there, I guess, a little bit with my producing.
Yeah, well, and it's so freeing to be able to just focus on the actual character and the soul of the music. And I primarily, I came from the electronic world. So producing future bass and dubstep and performing future bass and dubstep. And I still do. But for me to be able to jump into a lo-fi track after I just spent, you know, 12 hours on a dubstep tune, just trying to get everything as crispy and clean as possible. It's so freeing to not necessarily stress about the overall, the engineering quality necessarily, and to be able to literally just sit down and write and not have to ask myself like, oh, okay, is this a banger on the dance floor?
Is this serum patch the right one?
Exactly, man. Exactly.
might know some mutual people in that world. Do you know a guy named Pronounced Yeah? He's kind of like more. He's like an Armada guy.
No, I don't.
I have a handful of friends in the like electronic world that are. I have a bunch of friends that worked at Owsla too.
Which
the office is in Chinatown. It's like really close to where I live here, and it's a cool world. Yeah, it's I love dance music so much, and I love all the different aspects of it. And the new Flume record is like absurd. It's been bumping it. That and the Porter Robinson one have just been like on repeat for me and some friends.
That's great, man. I was actually at Flume at Red Rocks two nights ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No way. How was it?
Oh, it was awesome. And that was only my second time seeing Flume. I saw him at a festival, I think like 2016. And then just being able to see him at Red Rocks. And once again, I'm super biased, but I like Red Rocks is just the most phenomenal venue.
It's amazing. And I've never been to a show there, but I've been there during the day to see like what it looks like. I'm just like, wow, it'd be so cool to go. I saw Flume at Coachella earlier this year, and it was before his record came out. And so he played all those songs, and I was like, this is cool. Like, I don't recognize any of this, you know? But then I listened to the record later, and I remembered like the live experience. And it was cool. And they got me hooked on the record, like the opposite of how you would consume records, I guess.
His, Siren, I remember, and I think he dropped Siren as a single. Leading up to the album release, I believe. And it's just like the sound design and his ability to utilize resonant sounds, which would typically sound terrible, in such a creative and quality way, it's just beyond impressive. And he's definitely been a big influence of mine.
Totally.
Since like, 2013, 2014. But then as far as your friends working at Owsla, Skrillex is, I saw Skrillex back-to-back nights in 2014 at Red Rocks, and that's when I decided, like, I'm making electronic music. Like, whatever he's doing up there right now, like, that's what I'm doing. So that's really cool that you have homies that were able to be a part of that movement.
Yeah, totally, yeah.
And you said you did touring in your late teens, early 20s?
Yeah, I mean, through I just turned 30, so through a bunch of my 20s too, I did a bunch of touring. So the Inspired in the Sleep band was pretty active, and I had this band in high school called Tan Sister Radio, and then a couple others, and some people that I played for. And that was just kind of my MO growing up. I was like, I wanted to be a band kid, you know. I wanted to do like the rock and roll thing, and I learned a lot. I really did, and I think I learned like the drive that you need to have in this industry. Mm-hmm. Because like we, back in the day, like my high school band, we would be, you know, booking tours on MySpace and playing record shops for like three people and like still carrying massive amps to get into that, you know?
Yeah.
And nowadays, like, you know, I'm starting to do the lo-fi thing live a little bit, and I do have a live band for it, which has been cool, but awesome. I also just really like DJ sets and like 404 sets and the simplicity of like performing music in a lot more like, different setting, of course, but also like a streamlined approach actually from the tech standpoint of just like, let's get the set list dialed. And I did a ton of touring. And then I think when COVID hit, which, you know, for a lot of people, especially in live here in LA, I got into lo-fi. I'd always listened to it. My boy Rod over at Dashco, which I'm sure a bunch of people know in this world. I saw him at like a conference thing, a music conference back when Inspired in the Sleep was going, and Inspired in the Sleep was on Dashco. And I saw Rod, and he was like, one day we'd been using like samples in our records, you know, we'd sample a bunch of vinyl records, and he was like, man, he's like, I really like your style. Like, you should get into lo-fi. And I was like, lo-fi? I was like, oh, yeah, I've listened to that a little bit when I was like doing computer work or whatever. And I tried it a little bit, but I didn't really take it that seriously. And then COVID hit, and it was like, all those other things like shows and you know, different stuff that was keeping me active in that world all went to a halt. And so it was like, what else are we going to do, you know?
Yeah.
And that's when I really kind of got into it. And then I started releasing it and it started doing well. And I was like, man, like this is something that comes really naturally to me. Mm-hmm. It's not an aspect of my creative career where I have to really push something or fight something or really like, you know, yeah. And then I got really into it. And now I'm just making tons of music and releasing tons of music all the time. So,
yeah. Well, and Max, I love your story, man, because so many of us share that same similarity. And before really diving into the lo-fi community and creating and releasing lo-fi, similar story. I think we had a couple shows in Ohio, late February, early March of 2020. We were dialing in a set to bring back to Denver, play a bunch of Denver shows, and then COVID happened. And it was just an immediate hard pivot to creating and releasing lo-fi beats. And I know Jonas Hoffy Beats shares a similar story. Gosan shares a similar story. You share a similar story. Like, it was such a pivotal moment for a lot of us that were performing live. Like, it was like, oh, well, this isn't a possibility anymore. Like, okay, well, what else can we do? And now here we are. And I'm assuming that you feel the same way, but that grind, the competitiveness, the phone calls, the booking live shows, and me coming from the electronic world, and I'm assuming the indie world is relatively the same, but it's so competitive. Such a grind to try and grow your project, to get those shows booked, and then people don't want to share their contacts for this person. It's like it's not necessarily a community full of people trying to help each other grow, which in contrast, as soon as I jumped into the lo-fi scene, everybody that I worked with was just trying to benefit each other of like, hey, well, let's work together and let's grow. Like, hey, what's the email address for this label? Or have you worked with X label? Yeah, I know.
Yeah, way more relaxed, whoever. I think, yeah.
And it's so, oh my goodness. I feel so lucky, and I try not to take for granted. And still being in the electronic world, sometimes there's moments that happened within that scene where I'm just like, oh, like, come on, guys, like we can all help each other out. Like we don't have to, like we're not in competition with each other. Like we can be a part of the same team.
Yeah. I mean, I think overall it's counterintuitive to what we all want to do. I think, especially as artists and musicians, like, you know, LA is super cutthroat. And there's almost like a little bit of maybe a bit of it comes from like jealousy or whatever, or envy, or just this kind of knack to like kind of push other artists down, or, you know, with not really, you know, like with not really too much reason, when I think just being as supportive as possible and making a community is your best bet of doing anything amazing. And then there's, you know, when it comes to money, there's not a lot of money in this industry to begin with. And I've noticed one thing is like, when you actually do start making money, there's all these people that want to like figure out how to get a bit of it or like convince you that you need something in order to, you know. And so it is, it's super difficult to navigate sometimes. And you really have to like find a team that you trust. However, in the lo-fi space, especially on the artist end, like, yeah, totally. It's just this total kind of open source community of everyone wants to just help each other out. I think it's always assumed that, I think this is a quintessential thing in lo-fi. It's like always assumed a 50-50 split on anything that you work on, you know?
Yep.
Which in pop music and different, you know, different realms, it's not always the case. And I think it's kind of funny because I'm going through my catalog and I'm trying to just get all my split sheets out so I have it all in writing. But I was thinking about it and they're like, man, there's never a split sheet with a lo-fi collab before anything gets out. It's always just like, yeah, like let's do it, man. Like, and you know, they add the sauce and you add the sauce and mm-hmm. you cook something up. So
yeah, it we're lucky, man. We really are. And I think the more that we can do to just consistently remind ourselves of how lucky we are to be part of such an open and helpful community, where driving revenue is a possibility. Like how when you first started like touring, like how long did it take for you to actually like make some money, you know, or be in the black? And even, and I'll preface it with my electronic project, Crystal Grid. Like we have a solid fan base. We've played a lot of cool shows. The project is Crystal Grid.
Crystal Grid. Okay, cool. I'll check it out.
Yeah, yeah. I'll send you a link after. And you know, we've had that project for 5 years, and the amount of money I've spent and the amount of money Jared, the other half of Crystal Grid, has spent, like there's no way we're in the black. Like we're undoubtedly in the red
to make all these things happen.
For sure. And so to be able to be within a genre where, especially with an independent release, like if you can hit a big editorial with an independent release, it's like, oh wow, okay, it's mm-hmm. possible to drive some serious revenue from your art. So
I on the topic of the live thing, I think it's not easy. It was never easy, and I've lost money on tours. I've made some money on tours, never an insane amount. And but I don't. What I think is even more daunting is like how do bands do it now? Mm. Because you know, at least over here, gas is like almost $6, and like just the cost of living has gone up. And I think the sad thing is booking fees and stuff and for talent hasn't necessarily gone up.
No,
you know, it's not like artists are making a lot more money than they were 2 years ago in the live space. So, especially with like Live Nation having a control on mm-hmm. most things, but I think it's a labor of love. Like my drummer, I have a live band version, and he plays drums on it, which has been really fun. He just tours; that's all he does, and that guy grinds and hustles more than a lot of people I know in this town.
Yeah.
Like sometimes it's just a thorn in his side at how difficult it is, but sometimes, you know, he gets to have these experiences and he absolutely loves what he does, you know, and getting on stage is like his whole thing. And so I think you just gotta like die for it.
Yeah.
You gotta really live and make a lot of sacrifices to do it, and it can be done. And I think it is progressive. You know, it's like you build your tour markets after a while, and then you're like, okay, well, you know, when I come to Denver, Colorado, I know like we have an idea of how we're going to do it, but you have to be there like I don't know half a dozen times, and before you really know what that looks like. So mm-hmm. a lot of sacrifice and a lot of time commitment and a lot of work for sure. But it's totally worth it. Super valuable.
Totally, dude. Well, and I love what you said, like labor of love. And it's I'm certainly grateful that I've reached the point where I can talk about revenue and actually start crunching numbers. But there was a lot of years where it was just me buying stuff on a credit card and losing money, you know, for a majority of years until could turn a profit. And even now, if I wasn't turning a profit, I'd still be doing it. It's that labor of love. It's the absolute need. It's like, what else would I be doing? And it's like, oh, I'd be doing this exact same thing.
Yeah. If you can make music and you really enjoy and love what you do and make a living off of it too, that's a blessing. It's just, it's not that it don't, when you go to college, they don't have like a quick little, you know, a couple courses you can take to jump into that. It's sort of like something you have to really commit to. And I have been full-time music probably for like, I want to say like 5 years now.
Nice, dude.
Maybe a little more, but that took like 10 years to get there. Mm-hmm. And it was always what I wanted to do. I mean, I worked other jobs and did other things, but I was like, you know, I feel really fortunate to be in that space. And, it is a blessing. I think sometimes there's a bit of a conversation of like, when money does get into play of like, your artistic integrity of like, you know, what are you doing or making? And, you know, this happens in all genres really, but like, what are you doing that's like really aligned with your brand and what you're trying to do as an artist? Or, you know, what are you doing to like pay the bills, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Because you'd rather not do another job, you know, you wouldn't do something in music. And, you know, I've done a bunch of like sync music and different creative projects that kind of delineated from what I, you know, using my creative energy for like maybe not the best, what ideally what I'd want it to be used for. But it was all a means to end and end. And I've learned, been perpetually learning about producing and writing through that.
Yeah, well, and I love that concept. And I, Stephen Pressfield's my favorite author of all time. He wrote the War of Art is his flagship book, and he talks about in regards to artistic identity. He talks about the ego and the self, and like the artist is always trying to, as often as possible, create art from the self, live from the self. But the like the ego is important because the ego is what pays the bills, and that's kind of how he breaks that down. And I appreciate that because it's we want to be connected on some sort of higher plane of consciousness as artists, right? As airy fairy as that sounds, that's what we're trying to do. But you gotta pay the bills. You have to get your oil changed. You have to, you know, like there's things that you do have to do that's not necessarily a part of that artistic process. That's just a reality of life. And in regards to like sync licensing and getting creative with your art, I'd rather get off brand a little bit in regards to my artistic path to be able to drive revenue from music rather than getting a part-time job that doesn't push me forward artistically.
And just takes you out of music altogether. Yeah.
Totally. Well, and like it's like if you think about, I mean, even an actor, right? Like you would undoubtedly be more familiar with this since you're in the mecca of the acting world, but like an actor taking a dish soap commercial so they can continue to pursue their dream as getting on a show or a movie. It's like, well, can you blame them? You know, that's not their dream. That's not,
I think the only fear in that situation is that then they become the dish soap guy.
Ooh,
you know,
totally, man.
you're the glad guy, right?
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. As a concept, artists want to be known for, ideally what they think is their, you know, like their best representation of, but it, you know, things often also like happen in different ways, you know, like all those, a lot of hits were like going to be B-sides on the album or something like that, you know, like those kind of instances of just, you also never know what people are going to resonate with. So I think having I had a call with my therapist yesterday. We were talking about having intention with everything that you do, you know? I think that's a big part of the artist process of like, and I also do think that the ego does pay the bills, but the ego also like is a part of the artistic process a little bit, just in the sense that like, I don't know, even if you're like kind of, you just have to lunge for something and really conceptualize and put an intention to it. And you have to be confident in it. I think I'm constantly like looking at when am I being self-conscious in my producing, and producing is just a lot of these like quick decisions you're making for a greater whole, right? And you know, if you second guess everything as you do it, it might not be as like clear and profound as what you're trying to do initially. So it's such a balance of all those things and all these different types of energies and stuff, but. Definitely like having intention and at least like deciding like this direction you want to go in or what you want to do. And then, and if that means taking risks or not, which oftentimes it does, the best stuff usually does. So, and then just going for it, you know, like that's kind of the best you can do as an artist. Cause I like to think I can go into the studio every single day and I'm going to make the best song that I've ever written, or I'm going to like write the best, like produce the best thing or whatever it is. And that's just not the case, but yeah. You do need to show up every day if you're mm-hmm. going to get to that point. So
it's, yeah. And Max, you nailed it, dude. And it's showing up every day. And the further along I get in my career and really just life as a whole, it's balancing those moments of not operating at 100% and being okay with it. And so I'm definitely a hyper productive guy for sure. And that, and I love
seems like it
life like this. Yeah. Well, so like I wake up in the fives every morning, or try to like this. Yeah. So I do that. I train for ultra marathons, balancing a bunch of different podcasts, just doing all of these things that bring me happiness that are also extremely difficult. And I fell into a trap, really last year, of trying to never not feel 100, and what a dangerous trap that is. And I still,
oh, yeah.
I still, you know, like biohacking, intermittent fasting, reading books. Like I still I meditate every day. Like I still have a massive list of to-do items that help me continuously grow. But I fell into the trap of that hyper productivity mindset of like not being willing to get myself tired, which ended up getting me in, not external trouble, but internal trouble. And
sure.
I've been sober for the past 8 months. So if people can tie a story together. But so that's been honestly my biggest lesson over this past year of like, okay, like when you're like, can you recognize when you're actually tired and like when you do need a break? And like this morning I slept until 7 because I went to that Flume show. Drove us back to Southern Colorado that same night, like stayed up till five in the morning, like driving us back home. And
oh, wow.
And so like, of course I'm going to be tired. Right. And in a previous life, it's like, oh, well I could just get something that's going to make me not tired. Easy.
Yeah.
Instead of just just being like, it's okay to be tired, man. Just chill. And so I slept till 7 this morning, which for me is like, I get to sleep in. But
so I don't make any decisions before 10 a.m. most days. So I'm kind of on an opposite schedule. But I do work. I mean, I work late when it's time to work. So sometimes I'm up way later or, you know, a show, similar things. So.
Yeah. Well, it's, so in the past 5 years of pursuing music full time, like what are some of the biggest lessons that you've learned in the past 5 years that you're implementing now, especially in the sense of self-management and being your own boss?
Yeah. I think one rule that I'd like to say is, I mean, there's a bunch of stuff I could jump onto, but, definitely manage yourself, as much as possible. Until you're too busy to manage yourself and you need a manager. And I think a lot of people are self-managed. And I recently started new management a couple months ago. And it's a situation where I have that much more understanding of the industry and of my worth a little bit and the things that I'm signing or things I'm jumping into now from doing this independently for so long. And also like working dynamics with other artists, musicians, graphic designers, et cetera. Like that's really laid the groundwork to now, till you get to a point, you know, like a lot of artists like start and they're like, oh, I'm going to be the best thing ever. I need a manager, which is true. It's true. But I think if you skip that step of not just learning the lay of the ground, because it's a changed industry and I don't think there's much room for, you know, people like born with a industry golden spoon or whatever to where they just jump into, they get to skip all the other steps. I don't know, like the work ethic thing kind of is always something that rings true to me. It's just, you got to like lose yourself in it and you have to sacrifice yourself and you have to sacrifice a lot of things which are going to really tear you apart. But it's, if you keep at it, it's worth it, and it takes you to all these new places. What else would I say? Learning how to navigate like relationships in music and learning how to communicate. I think a lot of artists and even industry people, I feel, can be rather just different in the way they communicate. I don't want to say like bad at communication, but just everyone's different, and I've noticed that you really have to navigate those situations and I think like these conversations come up a lot more when I'm talking to lawyers or stuff like that, because there's so much emphasis on like just understanding what it is we're all agreeing to and every possible like implication that could come along with that or variable the way it goes. That's super helpful. I also think, like the intention thing is a big part of this, while keeping in consideration, like I had a bit in my career where it was like, I was like, okay, what's working and what's not working, you know, like what's moving you forward that you enjoy and is fulfilling for you. And what's like moving you forward or like not moving you forward. And maybe it's fulfilling or maybe it's not as fulfilling as it was, you know, for these other reasons. But, knowing what you want to do and the vision that you want to do with being flexible to the millions of options that there are, I would say. Because before I moved to LA, like I was like, oh, I want to do music. And it was like so simple. I was like, okay, well, you pick up the guitar, you write a song, you join the band, you go on tour, you make the hit record, da 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 da. Like, that's it. Easy. For sure. Like, chill. I got this. And then when I got to LA, I think I kind of like was seeing all these different avenues of music that I never had like been aware of before. You know, there's the guys that and girls that just tour and just play for people and are insanely like prowess at their instrument, but don't really write or don't really don't really produce or anything like that. And then there's the opposite side. There's the players that are just in the studio or the producers that don't play a single instrument but can like make these crazy pop records or dance records. And I think there's just so many facets to it that like that kind of blew my mind when I first got here of like, whoa, this is like a lot bigger than I initially thought. So that concept of like having your intention and going in and honing in on what it is you're trying to do or say or, you know, evoke, but also being flexible to the way life happens and the way things change. You know, it's also a very fast changing industry. It's like, you know, we're like the lo-fi thing could not be a thing in 5 years, you know, when Spotify shuts down or something like that. Like, It's just the reality that you have to come to terms with. So,
yeah. Well, I love the intentionality piece, and then being flexible enough, or wise enough to identify aspects that are out of your control, and not letting those affect you. But back to the intentionality thing. So, like as you're navigating daily life, like how often are you thinking about intentionality throughout your day? Like before you, like every time you change an activity, like are you thinking about your intention?
Yeah. No. You would like to be, right? You'd think you know, and I don't know, when you were talking to me a little bit about what did you say? It was like always feeling great all the time or something like that. I think part of the existential crisis, at least for me personally, I've reached in that vein is like, you can't always feel great. You know, you can't always, you can do all the steps to help ensure that. But I've definitely experienced a little bit of like extra pressure on myself when I think that I'm always going to be like, and even on this intentional thing, like intentional is like you create the meaning and then you're not distracted by any other meaning. You're just going towards that. But if you go to, you know, but if you're in a state of mind where you're like, you know, you're not focusing on the intention that you have, well, you know, like, how can I alleviate that, or how can I fix that? That's kind of brought in more like existential anxiety for me of like, man, you know, and I think the things you can do is like, there's concrete deliverables and decisions and practices you can do. Just take care of yourself to begin with. And that's going to help you feel better and great in all time. But also just to be okay with that you're not always okay, you know, like, and finding some comfort in that, like, or comfort in the turmoil, I guess, a little bit, or like, I don't know, like shaky waters of like, you know, I'm starting to get into a mental health mode here, but I think it's also with the creative process too, because like you always, you know, of course, if you're in the best possible mood, and you just ate a salad and an acai bowl and like worked out and did all the freaking things that are gonna make you feel great. Yeah, overall, like you do tend to, I think, make better work for sure. Mm-hmm. And I know, yeah, like, but also I think there's something to be said of just about getting in the studio, doing it even if you hate it at the time, and then listening back and being like, whoa, like actually that section right there was like pretty amazing. Like, I think I can expand on that. And that's being open to like, like surprising yourself,
yeah,
with what you can do, even in not the best headspaces, but definitely like having the intention at the same time of just this is you know, this is what I want to do, and it's kind of more of an overarching thing. Like, for instance, Urchin, like I started a lot doing like instrumental stuff in lo-fi, and I come from like a songwriting world, and I was like, man, I'm just missing like songs in this a little bit, and. There are songs that are like purely instrumental that I'm like really feel connected with in a lot of ways, but for the most part, I'm taking the Urchin project into like a more vocal lo-fi range with pretty much all of the new stuff or a lot of it, and that was just like it was kind of like we were talking about touring a little bit. I did one of my first like lo-fi tours, or I started playing shows in lo-fi, and I come from the live world, and like I would play some of these like super down tempo, you know, like tracks that I've made, and they might have, you know, they probably maybe did well like on platforms or whatever like that, and I was like, man, this just is not, some people know this song or whatever because there was some people that came to the show for it, but it was like, this is not hitting for this environment, you know. And so I think we need to like really hone in on this specific the ways music's consumed in the different environments and the intentions that it serves. So, but the one thing I was missing with these live shows is like, man, I want to bring this like songwriting element back into it. And I, you know, like you, with you in the dance world, like I've done some work in the dance world too. And I'm like, man, I want to get people dancing. And so those are kind of the two directions that I'm going with it. And it was something where I like, because I just finished the Urchin album, at least like the bulk of the demoing and writing for it.
Awesome.
And
congrats.
It was like a kind of on this topic of intention. It was like just the like, this is the concept. This is what I'm going to go for. I have a feeling of what I want to do. And it's I'm really happy with sticking to that, I guess, you know.
Yeah. Well, and I want to hear more about this, your most recent tour, because I remember when I first launched my lo-fi project Summit One, I had friends reach out and just like, hey, are you going to do shows at Summit One? And I gave them such a staunch and quick reaction. No, like just with, for like Crystal, when I'm playing live electronic music, it's like that energy is just so unreal. So when they initially asked me, I was just like, no, that's not my plan. But like there, especially in Europe too, and now with you and what you just did this past like early summer, late spring, I think there is a space for live lo-fi, especially with festivals like a heavy electronic music festival couldn't use a chill out tent that features lo-fi artists. And so I think there is this space, and there's so many talented artists within our community that are starting to push that forward, and I'm excited to see what it turns into. But so how many shows did you play on this most recent tour?
It was a relatively short run, but it was, you know, I think it was definitely like, there's not a lot of lo-fi tours happening, so it really felt like this unique thing. But and we played a lot of different styles of clubs too, but I think it was like a six show run of sort. And then I think there was one fly date to San Antonio, and then a handful like on the West Coast and in Phoenix. And I think that's the one thing I'll say about it, is I learned a lot and I had a blast. Marcus from Ultimate and Hertz both hit me up about like hey, we should do this, like we're planning this tour, da 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 da, like would you want to. They saw that I was starting to do some gigs around town in LA, and I had worked with Marlon from Hertz on track before. And they kind of asked me, they're like, you know, I think I was like the one of their friends that they saw doing Lo-Fi Live and playing sets and stuff. And they asked me to do this tour, and I was like, yeah, sure, let's go. Like,
yeah,
let's do it. And I definitely did learn a lot, but like kind of back on this topic of like where and how we experience music. Because we played all sorts of different clubs. Like we were at like more of a dance club one night, and then one night it was more of like a proper venue that would be set up for a live band or whatever. And then one night was just sort of like a little bit more like cocktail lounge. This spot in Chinatown and played called Melody Lounge. So it was just kind of like chill, fun hangs with friends DJing. And then there was one set, which this is probably the best show that we played, is up in San Francisco. And I think every lo-fi producer that's maybe interest or like, you know, producer of any kind really, but that's interested in playing live should check this venue out. It's called Envelope. It's up in San Francisco in the Bay Area. And it's this really rather small venue. They mostly do seated shows, like 40 cap or so. But there's 32 speakers like surrounding the entire audience that go, there's four subs. And then there's these like, I think there's like these six towers that go up. And then there's speakers above the audience too. And it's really interesting. The team's like really, they're really good people, and everyone associated with it. And they have their own, native Ableton plugins, to control things a little bit. I could send a stem that I was playing on my set. I could send it through a delay that is going up the X and Y axis or spinning around the audience. Or,
wow.
I mean, the options are like kind of infinite. And so it's really a unique experience. And I would say, especially as a producer, if a lot of your interest goes into sound design and the way things, specific sounds go, like really, really interesting. Definitely like something to look at if you're a performer of any sort, especially in the lo-fi space, you know?
That sounds like such an immersive audio experience. That definitely piques my interest, dude. There's so much you could do with that, especially with like lo-fi beats, chill hop, ambient. Like, so from a marketing perspective,
they do like sound. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Sorry. No, you go for it, man.
Oh, all I was going to say is they do like sound baths and stuff.
Wow.
They do a lot of different styles of music. But they also do like, you know, like record, just listening to records, people come in and listen to records, and they do sound baths, and then they do artists as well. And so, but it's, as an artist, it's such an experience to play there, and everyone really gets what you're going for, I guess.
Yeah, well, I kind of want to, so diving, I mean, it's almost like it's funny, like psychedelic set and setting. So set and setting for lo-fi live shows, what do we do for live shows to really start pulling people in to attend these shows? Because we, of course, within lo-fi, we have a lot of passive listeners, which is great. That's awesome. We get to impact millions of listeners across the globe. And so what I always compare it to is even if you and I release two singles that we didn't collaborate on, we're still collaborators in the sense of fans of lo-fi. Like there's a lot of fans of lo-fi that might not even necessarily have favorite artists. They're just fans of lo-fi, mm-hmm. which to me is beautiful. Like if they're just fans of the genre, we all get to collaborate together. Now, of course, I think it is important to try and have a distinguished sound and to begin to pull some of those passive listeners into active listeners and active fans. But from that live element, like what do you think the future is in regards to marketing? How do we get people to come out to a lo-fi live show?
I think a lot of it has to be a means of being creative with how you present what, you know, the concept of what the show is. So, you know, my manager's talked about this a lot because, like, he knows I want to do live stuff a bunch. And he's saying, like, creating a space that is conducive with this type of music is, like, something mm-hmm. that is really ideal because... yeah, like I think, you know, at these festivals, at these big style festivals, there needs to be a tent. There are like things that are similar and more like kind of those relaxing style like tents or something. But there needs to be one that's like a dedicated lo-fi. I think Evie was on like Coachella at one point too. I'm wondering what that would be like. But like a dedicated tent for like, oh, you know, I'm going to go chill out and charge my phone. And talk yeah. to my friends, and I'm going to be surrounded in mist, you know, like a mm-hmm. Doolab, but like lo-fi, yeah. or like there's going to be,
yeah,
you know, yerba mates on tap or mm-hmm. something like that. Definitely AC, you know. But I think that has to do with it quite a bit. I also think like I've seen some lo-fi producers like playing live shows at like studies, mm-hmm. like studying meets or like study sessions, like at universities or something like that. There's this yeah. like, I think that's a really creative idea because it's obviously lo-fi is so like, you know, attributed to like the studying culture. I also think, I think this sort of immersive sound thing is kind of an exciting new thing. Like we're looking at a show in November in LA and I don't know yet if it's going to happen, but I'm trying to get a friend of mine in audio production to bring out this like surround sound, like it's like 8 or 12 speaker setup to throw a show, but have a show where it's like you are immersed in this like 360 sound, and Envelope is like that idea on crack essentially.
Yeah. Because
it's every possible parameter. But yeah, I think like acknowledging, and I learned this a lot on the tour, acknowledging the space in which you're, the space in which like you're performing and what the music is intended for. I'm sure a lot of lo-fi producers are frustrated with the fact that like they have a, you know, more of a passive audience than an active audience. And, but also I think there is some glory of like you're really providing, like for me, writing lo-fi through the pandemic is like probably the most relaxing thing for me.
Yeah.
And for my mental state of being. And I think in a way the reason that was so is because you're creating something that's it's therapeutic in a sense. You know, and I've so interesting to me that I've like I tend to always go create more in a relaxed type of music as opposed to something that creates pressure or stress, which is, you know, stress is also excitement and having fun mm-hmm. and like, you know, being out of your shell and living. And so, but I think being as a performer, you really need to think, what am I walking into and how can I like play to the crowd a little bit? Like, you know, and as a DJ, you know, like middle school, I've had him come out and do like a lo-fi night we had. And he's like, I just want to play drum and bass. And I'm like, go for it, dude. Let's do it. I'm like, that sounds amazing. And it was. It was like a super killer set. So, you know, having fun with it, you know. But like in terms of marketing, I think this kind of like extra factor, I think there's a lot of like sponsorships in like our yeah like brand sponsorships with like weed brands, I think would be really a smart idea. I think like adding these elements like visuals and you know immersive audio and different things like that is all will all that's the best approach, at least from the shows that I've played. Otherwise, like play. There's also like lo-fi music that's very much dance music, you know. And when I play DJ sets at like clubs that are more geared toward dance, I like will throw some of my music in there, and there's definitely like some new music that I think has dance elements that I really enjoy playing. But I also am just like, this fucking track slaps. Like I'm gonna, this makes me want to dance, so I'm gonna play this, you know. And So that's, you know, that's thinking like a DJ though too. You gotta kind of keep that in mind. So, but the options are pretty infinite.
Yeah, you definitely you have my wheels turning, Max, and I think there's such a bright future for our community. And of course, I probably unexpected challenges potentially, you know, just like you mentioned, if Spotify goes down, like a lot of us are going to have to rethink what we're doing. But I really think there's a ton of possibilities for this lo-fi live element. And I've definitely jotted down some notes and want to reflect on these even further. And Max, just in closing, man, is there anything you want to share with, let's say, an up-and-coming producer, somebody that's been producing for like 2 or 3 years that wants to become a full-time musician? What would you say to yourself at that like 2 to 3 year mark? What if you could go back in time and give yourself a little pep talk? What would you say?
I would say kind of touching on what I was saying before is just like once you know you like you have what you love and you want to do, it's like it's so clear. Right. At least it seems like that. Like, oh, I just want to do this. Like, I want to do this. I'm going to move to LA or I'm going to move to New York or, you know, and it's daunting the amount of things you're going to have to go through to get to where you want to be or even get to a place that's like somewhat comfortable way of living, trying to do it full time. But I think as long as you just attribute that to your identity of like, that's who I am. Like, you know, I have friends that are like, I'm a drummer. I'm not going to get a coding job. I'm not going to, you know, like that's, and the reason that some of them have found really good success is because they just kept at it. Like, you know, you really can't stop and, you really can't let constructs, get in the way of like, you know, thinking you need this or thinking what your life would be like if you went away to college like the rest of your friends did or whatever. You just have to keep going. And I think, again, also being like being flexible with yourself and being being open to possibilities and you know, like, which is there's so many different avenues, you know. So like if you're not the pop star. Also, never give up on being the pop star you wanted to be when you're a rock and roll star you wanted to be when you're 15. Never give up on that. But if 10 years down the road, you've found yourself in this whole different vein of something that you're enjoying in ways you'd never even knew you would or could, like, I mean, you know, run with that too. You know, like 1,000%. do it feels right, I guess is what I'm saying. Do it feels right, because I definitely started off with a lot of things that I would like. I was like, you know, this is in, and then I ended up in different ways that I never expected. And I hear that from people in all other like different aspects of the industry. Like, never once did they think they would be here when, you know, when they started 10 years ago. So be open, be open and be diehard. And take that intention and move forward with it, and if things deviate, that's all a part of the process.
Max, that was a perfect inspirational.
Is that a good ending there?
That was good, dude. That got me hyped up.
That got deep.
It really did, man. Well, I just love the like being open, just being open to experiences. Like when I really dove into this dream, like I never thought that I would have a podcast. You know?
Yeah.
It just happened, and now it's one of my favorite things ever. Like what?
Yeah. Yeah.
This conversational art form has been a joy, and that was just something that happened that I said, okay, yeah, sure, I'll do it. Yeah, that seems like a cool idea. Let's do it. But Max, that was perfect, dude. I just want to thank you for taking time out of your day and joining me for a conversation. I know this certainly won't be the last episode with you on the Chilled Samples podcast. So
I listened to the In Love Squido one. I want to do like a group one with some friends or something. That would be super fun.
Let's do it, dude. Yeah, we'll make it happen. I'm 100% in.
Cool. Hell yeah.
Okay, we'll do it. We'll chat after we stop recording, and we'll get it locked in, dude.
Yeah. I'll hit up some friends.
All right.
Cody, thank you so much.
Of course, brother. And everybody tuning in, as always, thanks for listening. Peace.
Bye.